watch these in bed anymore. All I have left is Alien.
That's what you're going to fall asleep to. No.
Yeah, not a fun thing to fall asleep to.
But yeah, so just to add to our, you know, our first meeting lore.
Yeah.
And my first, my love at first sight, I guess.
Okay.
Okay.
No, you made it clear it was not love at first sight. Okay.
I was trying to be nice.
You were not being nice. Okay. What movies impacted us the most growing up? I've said it a lot on this podcast. I'd like talk about it too much. I think movies that have been like connected to film bro culture, unfortunately, but also like obviously are very connected to my youth because of like what is in our algorithms is just shared between everyone, like, but it's very gendered. And so like I grew up watching a lot of David Fincher films, a lot of Ridley Scott movies, and a lot of action films. And so like I was inundated by like Michael Bay even. So it took me a while until really I was like 17, 18 to kind of get into the independent scene, get into like woman filmmakers, black filmmakers, people of color who were making movies for marginalized experiences that I would like try to build on top of and trying to understand like how the way cinema is not a perfect art form and the way systemic discrimination is like stopped certain identities from making movies and showing different experiences and not everything being about like the duality of man and like the tragedy of like being a masculine.
I love how you're like
the way that like everybody should be nihilistic because our country's falling apart at all times. Like it took me a while to get out of that scene.
Well, I love how you're like talking about it as if it's like truly your fault at like, because you're talking about young ages.
I mean,
like,
I was a guilty teenager. I know,
but you're talking about when you were a teenager, like
yeah,
when we were
guilty
teens, like
guilty.
We didn't have like mega social media. Like we didn't have like maybe more access besides like what is playing on like TNT and TBS.
No, yeah,
and
we didn't have Letterboxd. Okay, that would have changed my life.
And so like, not that people shouldn't like seek out things. I'm just saying it's like more of a like, systemic way that we like get media and like what is mm-hmm. considered like something that should show on TNT like every single, you know, month. And so like that was going to be my answer, like growing up. So Trey like had a really cool experience where his dad showed him a lot of really cool, but I guess dark movies for your age.
Yeah,
like
just tragic.
Right. Like Seven, we said. And
yeah, I mean, I wanted to stick with Alien first because I think Alien's my favorite movie of all time. And I just don't think that that movie purely has like a masculine lens. I think it's actually one of the most like feminist blockbusters ever made by a man. Okay, that's a very specific category, but like I do think it counts in that category. I do think that category matters because so many men have made blockbusters that are not about a woman's experience. I don't think the movie is necessarily like feminist, but you can have a feminist reading of that film, and I think it's fascinating too, and we will talk about that one day.
Yeah.
With obviously like Ripley and Sigourney Weaver's like one of the best performances ever. But I loved the creeping atmosphere of Alien as a kid, and I wanted to have that anxiety inducing experience in like every movie after it. And I think as a kid I was just searching for the next Alien, and obviously like, you know, in my 20s and I couldn't find it. And then like later in my 20s, I still can't find it. And I'm realizing that like blockbuster movies basically just got more and more in this like kind of copycat routine after films like Alien and Jaws. And so like once the franchises and IPs take over, like we really don't see the kind of originality in sci-fi and intention and anxiety inducing thrillers as we did in movies like Alien. So then as I kind of got through my teens, I started getting more interested into psychological thrillers because that seemed to be where the original ideas were. So that's where we have like Seven or Memories of Murder or Zodiac or films like that, or Silence of the Lambs, which is like a huge one for me growing up. So yeah, I think those movies were the ones. It wasn't just like a masculine thing that was speaking to me. It was just kind of like the claustrophobic feeling that I think I felt as a teenager that I was really attracted to was the most like relevant in Alien. And so that movie just spoke to me the most as a kid.
Okay.
And now speaks to me for different reasons, like in capitalism critiques, for example. So.
Right. And also like Ripley being hunted basically, like in all the different ways that were subverted.
And watching the movie with a different lens at the end, story. Like there's only three marginalized identities on on the Nostromo, and those are the only three identities left at the end of the film because the alien hunted down like all the white men in the movie.
All right, stepping on our
so
alien.
I'm just
pod
saying, like, there are certain lenses on that film that kind of change your experience with it once you've kind of like analyzed it that deeply. But it is one of those movies that's a very rich text that you're able to do it with. So that one is really is fascinating.
Yeah, can't wait for particular. Ridley to come out with Napoleon this year.
I'm a little worried about it.
You're worried? Because
the last duel, Ridley Scott is a special filmmaker in that he like chooses to like have a woman protagonist and like show the way that ways that masculinity are so targeted at kind of ruining women's lives in a lot of ways. And maybe if you want to call it toxic masculinity, whatever. But with Napoleon, I am interested that he's going to do that with, I think it's Vanessa Kirby. Is the co-star of that film. But I am a little bit worried because I'm seeing so much Joaquin Phoenix in the trailers, but I also know he did that with The Last Duel too.
Yeah.
He did that with Jodie Comer and like not showing her too much and like showing a lot of Ben Affleck's hair and like a lot of Matt Damon. and that movie, The Last Duel, is like one of the best films in terms of like exploring what men have done to women historically. And so like I'm hopeful about Napoleon, but it's also called Napoleon. You know what I mean? So we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. I think I know what the movie is going to be about in terms of the like,
yeah, the themes.
Yeah. But we'll see.
Yeah.
What happens. I think
what
for
about
me,
for you? Yeah.
Yeah. It was, you know, a dark time, I feel like, for little girls and movies growing up. Like we got a lot of like really, surface level stuff in the 2000s. Like I felt like everything kind of felt like weirdly like plasticky in the 2000s in terms of I don't know, like movies like Shopaholic, whatever. Do you know what movie I'm talking about?
No.
Okay.
But,
well, there are a lot
but
of
but my
like,
first thought was like Mary Kate Ashley Olsen movies or okay, like Lindsay
yeah,
Lohan
like,
films or like
yeah, just like movies that I think could be important to people as like kind of like cult classics of like nostalgia or something. But ultimately, like I felt like a lot of movies that were kind of marketed towards women, like in for me growing up, I now reflecting on them feel like there was a lot of like really like terrible messaging for little girls. Like there are a lot of like rom-coms that surrounded the idea of like a character at the center thinking like that she needed to base her kind of whole worth like on what a man thought about her. Like there are so many movies
or
with that premise.
The more kind of even darker lens, which is that a woman has to like, now that she's allowed in the labor force, she needs to spend her whole life trying to figure out what the best 9-to-5 is.
Yeah.
Which is like a really kind of like with kind of a postmodern, like late capitalism lens is like a really depressing way to structure a movie.
That's what I was saying. Like, I felt like it was dark times for a little bit.
But like,
bit.
What about like 13 going on 30? Like,
well, yeah, no, I mean, there were definitely like
The Devil Wears Prada.
I don't want to like paint a broad brush because there were like a lot of like movies that I love still and I like consider kind of like the 2000 cult classic-y, but there is something that is like surface level still about like some of those movies, even the ones I love, right? And anyway, so that's to say that I feel like I also had a different like movie focused upbringing where I only watched like things that were on like cable, right? For example, like the TNT reruns or whatever. So I got like kind of the what people would consider like rewatchable movies,
like
or
Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah. Or like, I mean, I also like watched a lot of action movies, you know, like a lot of like Bourne movies.
Jason Bourne trilogy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like,
yeah.
My mom did take me to like all the movies that were big budget, which ended up being a lot of Christopher Nolan movies. We talked about on the Dark Knight pod, how the Dark Knight kind of made me want to watch more and different movies.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I saw like all the kind of like big budget things in theaters. So I was at least in the conversation around those. But I don't know if anyone else has this experience for people who didn't have like parents who were really into movies. Like Trey, I had like a specific friend who would show me different movies. Like, so one of my friends would show me movies like Saved or like some random, like weird kind of independent movies where I'd be like, whoa, like I didn't know that this existed. If you have any stories like that, listeners, I would love to hear
let us know
who your friend was and like how they kind of showed you movies. Cause that was my experience, at least before we had kind of like access to finding movies on the internet. And then when I met Trey, like, Trey was also my other movie friend who like really, we, you know, obviously love movies. We don't need to talk about it.
Yeah. This is the podcast.
Welcome to the extra credits.
I should say, like, I don't have like a sob story when it comes to like choosing movies. Like every movie in one way or another that has like been financed by major studios has been speaking specifically to white men since the beginning of film in the United States. And like, we are now just getting to a more equitable place which we're not even really close to.
Even
for white women in like the early 2000s, they were kind of copy and paste molds of like, just like speaking to this very specific middle-class white woman who like wants a stable husband while also wanting a stable job. Like that's kind of what all the movies were, which is unfair to obviously women, but like it is like still speaking to like just our identities and not really giving much else. Cause there are other movies I will talk about, but like,
yeah, there are other like more independent movies like happening, you know, coming out during that time too, like that I obviously just wasn't aware of. But the question was like, what were you watching? And so like, also like, if you, you know, grew up, during the time, like obviously DVDs or like VHS tapes, right? Like, I don't know if you did this, but I would like exchange DVDs with friends. So like, some friends gave me like Little Miss Sunshine or like Kill Bill. And like, those would be things that I would like rewatch a lot and like forgot to give back, you know?
Yeah. No, I had a lot of that. I mean, for boys, like, I mean, not just boys, but like, it was a lot of like exchanging video games too. Like that was a big thing.
Yeah.
Is there a movie that comes to mind? This wasn't a question, but I'm just curious. That was like something that was provocative that as a young teen or preteen that had you talking to your parents a lot about it or friends? Because I was trying to like think about what the movie was for me, because I've talked about a lot, like in my college years, the two big ones were like Prisoners and Prometheus. Like when I was 18, 19, the two blockbusters that my friends at least saw were the ones that I wanted to talk about the most were those two movies, because one had to do with like the horrors of searching for immortality and or God, depending on how you read Prometheus, because it's a deeply religious film, but also a deeply non-religious film. So that's fascinating to talk about. And then Prisoners, which is kind of like just this American allegory, which we're going to get into very soon on the podcast.
Yeah. And for anyone who's like a, you know, fairly new listener, we did do Prometheus and Alien Covenant.
Yeah. With Eye the Duck, which was a ton of fun. Yeah. But I was trying to think like preteen years, teenage years, what were the ones I had the most questions about and that I was like provoked by? And the movie that kept coming up, which is in like in my top 100 list on Letterboxd, which I've somehow made, it's always changing every single day. I mess with it all the time. I'll never post my top 100 movies.
Trey has a lot of private lists.
Yeah, that, tons.
Yeah, you should just release to the listeners.
Eventually. I don't know if they'll care. But the one that is like very much like cemented in my top five that has like kind of just, I think is probably the biggest reason that I looked at movies differently in my young teenage years, preteen years, is John Singleton's Boys in the Hood. I think that movie changed my life. And I don't mean that in like some kind of sad white boy way where I'm like, oh, now I understand different experiences. It's not like I didn't have friends or people of color in my life that were struggling through gentrification or like cultural anxieties about like race relations. But like, I just like that movie specifically, just like using language like gentrification, which Lawrence Fishburne does use in the movie. Like I think I saw it first at like 11 or 12 and I had so many questions like for my parents when I watched that movie, and I had so many people I wanted to show that movie to, which I mean, still to this day, I'd love to show that movie to more people because I just still think it's like an underseen masterpiece. But like, and John Singleton like left us way too fucking soon because he had a lot, like so much more to give. But Boys in the Hood is like, I think the movie that I think provoked me to even get to that point where I would, you know, eventually want to make this podcast with you, because I don't think I would have thought at like such a high, like engaging intellectual is not the best word, but level like that, without that film.
Isn't it funny when we talk to people, like if anyone ever figures out that we have a movie podcast, because a lot of like movies that people who don't watch movies are familiar with are very like the kind of more surface level big budget movies that are coming out. Like, I don't mean, this is the one that comes to mind. So no hate towards people who like Fast and Furious movies. I've only seen one and I actually enjoyed it, but, well, but I'm
ironically
just saying, like,
liking them is a ton of fun.
Yeah. But I'm saying that like people often like think that we are talking about like all movies that are essentially, like, I don't know what another example of like the Dogs movie, that, you know, Will Ferrell just made or something, like, you know what I mean? Like people, I don't think who like movies like maybe know of all the different like independent movies, which is so cool. Like that,
the content versus art conversation. Yeah.
This community of people who are interested in seeking like independent filmmakers and seeking films that are actually trying to like say something about the world and like looking at different experiences. So like, I mean, I genuinely think of like, this sounds so like sappy or whatever, but I genuinely think of like film as like cultural, like education. And obviously like caveat of like, you know, there's not funding and money like put towards what needs to be focused on. So like, but like that is like why I love like our listeners and our community, because they are interested in looking at maybe more transgressive like films or texts, right? But for me, I mean, I didn't watch a lot of like movies that were necessarily challenging at a very young age, like you were saying, like you.
Yeah, but do you think it was there a movie? Well, so like most of our friends, for example, and I think not our listeners, because obviously they're more like cinephile like people, but do you think, is there a movie when you were in the kind of stage of wanting the blend of the best blend of content and art?
I got it.
Is there a movie?
I got it.
Because we've covered one on the show that seems kind of obvious is the one option. It's Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight. It seems like the best example of like ethical dilemmas.
Like, yeah,
like,
but I wasn't
conversation about commentary.
I wasn't like, let's have a conversation about Dark Knight necessarily. Okay. Yeah, I mean, you can go listen to our Dark Knight podcast. We talked about like why we thought Joker was an interesting character and everything at that time when we saw it. But I think for me, like specifically like Kill Bill was interesting to me.
Oh, wow.
At a very young age. Yeah. Just looking at like, I hadn't like never seen a popular movie that really showcased, or that's not the right word, but like focused on violence against women. And so like,
okay,
just the like
point.
Idea of like what happens to her at the very beginning of the movie and like sexual assault. Like I had never seen that in a major budget movie addressed
film.
Very directly. And I'm not saying, you know, Tarantino's like a feminist, but that was a movie where I was like, oh, okay, like,
oh my god,
film can focus
we've
on
we've never talked about Tarantino on the show.
But then another one which I haven't watched it in a really long time, but maybe I'm just thinking about it because of Bottoms in our conversation. So Emma Seligman said that one of her inspirations was the movie Saved. That movie, from my memory, and this is like when I was maybe like 11, or whenever, I don't know when it came out, but it was about like a teen who got pregnant and was like shamed by her peers. And I think she was like seeking an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And she went to a like religious private school.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was fascinating again. You can go listen to our Prometheus pod or like any other pod where we talk about religion. We just did The Exorcist with the Cinemathology, which I'm not sure when that's coming out, but yeah, like I think just any movies that were kind of like directly addressing different like contradictions within a system, like were things that I was not accustomed to seeing on like necessarily like Transformers or something. Right.
No,
that was like a huge, that were huge, like box office hits, when I was growing up. So,
and I
think, I mean, there are probably obviously a lot of different answers, but those are just the ones that are coming to mind.
Did you see, Perks of Being a Wallflower when you were in high school?
I did.
Okay, because I was going to say that one seems to define our high school experience pretty well. Like in terms of the kind of kids that were in our high schools, like that movie was pretty like, in terms of like a white middle class culture vibe, like and mental health becoming more of the cultural conversation for the youth. I think Perks of Being a Wallflower was like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I should have prepared my answer.
No, yeah.
Well,
no.
Wait, you asked that question.
I think I did.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so.
That was not one we got from a listener. The only other movie I'll mention, which I have already before, which it feels like the most un-David Fincher-like movie, is The Social Network, which I still think is probably the best movie of the 21st century with There Will Be Blood and others like Parasite and so on. But like, I think The Social Network just, it was like a pre-dystopian movie. Like that's how it felt when I was a teenager. I was like, oh, what's to come is going to be very scary.
That's a great way to put it. It does feel dystopian, like the tone that Fincher creates.
A prequel
on this, like,
to Blade Runner.
College campus that is like the, you know, the pinnacle of like the
what we view as the intelligentsia of the United States or world. I think The Social Network kind of blew my mind as a teenager, and the way it was cut together too, and Jesse Eisenberg's performance and introducing or being introduced to Andrew Garfield on like such a large stage before Spider-Man like that was such a big deal. And Rooney Mara too, like at the beginning of that film with the first 5 minutes is so sick. And I just think that's like one of the most like one of the most cutting commentaries ever about like how one kid was bullied so badly that he wanted to monopolize, reality. And I think that that is like the scariest shit ever in a way that's like the best horror movie in a lot of ways ever. I think the Social Network in my teenage years, and I think in my 20s, I was trying to figure out again, a movie that, again, this is my question, but Sidney Lumet's Network is probably been the most impressive movie. I've been watching a lot of Robert Bresson films, which is a French filmmaker who is very famous to like cinephiles listening, but like, I think I've been watching a lot of great movies lately, which is another question later that I'll get into. So obviously there's a lot of other movies that we both love that have inspired us, because the question originally was, in case anybody forgot, what movies impacted you the most growing up? I'm just going to name a bunch real quick. I think through my teenage years, my 20s, Whiplash, talked about it a lot, Prisoners, The Social Network, Moonlight, There Will Be Blood, Boogie Nights, Goodfellas, Blade Runner.
Yeah.
The Lighthouse.
Yeah.
Movies I've talked about a lot. But I think in the past 3 or 4 years, me and Kelsey trying to build like our taste, because my taste has changed, I think, throughout the years. I think I've become more obsessed with like film history now and like international cinema. And I've been getting away from my more comfortable genres and themes. And I'm finding myself more interested. And I think we both are in like social satires. I think satire is like where we're both comfortable right now, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but I do find that our favorite films tend to be more satirical than not. Maybe that's just something that's happening in movies lately in terms of like this kind of postmodern meta humor, because everything is referencing something in movies now. Mm-hmm. And also social thrillers. Like I think Jordan Peele's Get Out like changed the landscape of movies for a lot of people in their young 20s when that came out. More recently, like Todd Field's Tar, which we argue was like more satirical than most people were taking it as. So I think that kind of meta lens on movies is kind of changing my relationship to what movies I'm interested in. And like I've said, I've started watching a lot of movies from the 1930s on recently. I think I watched a movie called Small Change a week ago, and it kind of changed my whole day that I was having. It was a Truffaut film, and it wasn't one of his like highest ranked movies, but I wanted to watch it because it was one of the only famous education movies I haven't seen.
Was this the one with the kids?
It was the one with the kids. It was kind of absurd, bizarre, but blew my mind as an education satire.
I kept like walking in and out of the room because I was like reading Marx upstairs, which is like my life now, to wake up at 6 a.m. and like...
and read Carl.
Read, different like Durkheim and stuff.
Yeah,
so, hilarious. But I kept walking down and I was like, what is this movie? Like, it was so compelling. Like, I kept staying for long periods of time. Like, I was like, I got to come back and just like watch the whole thing. But
I mean, I've watched a lot of Robert Bresson's movies and Bresson. I'm mispronouncing that. Sorry to our French listeners. But he's like kind of a genius, and I wasn't familiar with his work before. He had this like economic thriller that I watched, was maybe one of the most cutting and brutal takes on capitalism that I've ever seen. Called Largent, I believe. I don't know how to pronounce that. And then also A Man Escaped was really great. Recently, I think we both just watched a 5-star masterpiece that I saw as a kid, but you had never seen, which was Rosemary's Baby, which was excellent.
Yeah. For listeners really who have been following since the beginning of the pod, like, I have really just come to love horror movies. And so it's kind of cool. Like, I think a question later on, I remember if you picked that, because I remember someone asking, like, are there any movies like you're embarrassed that you haven't seen? And I think a lot of them probably were like horror adjacent. Like, people would always be like, you haven't seen that. But I view it as like a positive thing. Like, if anyone has ever told me that, like, okay, they've never watched, you know, a movie that I love, like, oh, you've never seen Goodfellas, or you've never, we're just rewatching Scorsese, so that's in my mind. Or, you know, you've never seen like Succession. I'm like, that's awesome. You get to experience what I wish I could like experience again for the
Succession's
first time.
Succession's the big
one. And so like for horror movies for me specifically, like, I don't see it as like a burden that I haven't seen movies. It just in general too. Like, I'm never, I think maybe because I'm, I don't know, like maybe this isn't like our full-time job, even though I do I do.
If it was our job where we were paying the bills solely through this, then we would be having to watch. I already do kind of watch 2 to 3 movies a day, but we would have to watch 4 to 5.
Well, I was going to say, like, I'm dedicated to like looking at what a filmmaker is pursuing in their filmography. Mm-hmm. And also, I, like Trey said, like, I'm increasingly becoming more interested in like older movies, and like, you know, there are obviously like so many references and like choices made now that are just like, you know, honoring like older movies. But as far as like horror movies, I'm never, or older movies, I'm never like, oh yeah, like I've never seen that. I'm like, yeah, I've never seen that. I'm pumped. Like, you know, like that's like my attitude about it. And I, cause I think it's so annoying when people are like, oh, you like, I don't know, are not a worthy film person because you haven't seen
something. That's us talking to ourselves. Like, I think we are film people enough. We're Knuff.
But anyway, Rosemary's Baby was awesome.
Yeah.
I loved it.
I mean, people can go on our Letterboxd and see what we've been up to. We've been watching a lot of good stuff. I watched a 1931, like, I watched a film called M last night, which I think a lot of film fans know. But if you're just a casual movie lover, then you've probably never heard of it. But it's like, kind of starts the wave of social thrillers, psychological thrillers that leads up to like Psycho and Silence of the Lambs and Seven and Prisoners and Memories of Murder and like, you know, movies that so many TV shows are based off of now, like any kind of like show, like what's the True Detective or something like that. Those are all inspired by this like German film.
And you said it connects a lot to Prisoners, right?
A lot to Prisoners, okay, which we'll talk about next week. Yeah. Also, you dropped that we were on an Exorcist pod on Cinemathology, which is a podcast that we'll put on our socials so people can go to them and follow them. They're a great show, one of our favorite pods to listen to. And they did a movie, they do classic movies, they follow directors, they just did a whole Scorsese series. But we came on for the William Friedkin series, that's like a kind of a sub-series they're doing. Mm-hmm. And they did The Exorcist, and we had a great like 2-hour-plus conversation about whether that film is the most successful horror or whether it's like the most interestingly religious conservative movie ever made, which is like fascinating. So it was a really fun discussion that I wish was on our show.
Yeah, I know.
It's so good. I think it was such a fun pod to have on theirs. So they were kind enough to have us on. We're going to have them on to talk about Prisoners, Denis Villeneuve's film from 2013 next week, because it's the 10-year anniversary. And it's one of my favorite movies of all time. And Jake Gyllenhaal is up to some shit in that movie. And we're going to be getting into that.
I'm so excited.
Okay. So I'm just going to get into the question that was asked the most.
Okay.
Would you ever quit your teaching job and do the extra credits full time? And I think that was asked when people only knew you were teaching. Now that, I mean, you are still teaching, but PhD is like more of a long-term
endeavor.
Yeah. I think the short answer is maybe. Yeah. I don't want to answer for both of us, but I think the short answer is maybe. Not to sound like corny, but like I feel weird about answering this question because a stable and reformed education system, like an optimistic education system where David Fincher's mind does not exist, that is like the most important and like thing in my life and has been for a long time, the thing I'm hoping for the most. And it is arguably the most important aspect of like a working democracy is like a working education system. So leaving education is an option, and not like us leaving it would break it, education or something like that. But I have only I'm a very existential person. We've said like we're atheists, so it's fine to say like I'm like think about like what my impact is going to be in the world by the time I'm not here anymore. And like the footprint I wanted to leave wanted to be in like education. And so I guess I'm only hesitating to kind of answer this, you know, in a very absolute way, to say, no, I'd never quit, or we'd never quit, because obviously I do think film, and I think we both think the arts and film specifically are very, very important to our lives and to culture at large. And there's an obvious like crossover of the arts and education. So I think we could both see ourselves taking a break from working in schools. And pivoting full time in this like movie and television coverage analysis space. I'm not sure what to call what we do.
Yeah.
We'll just say movie podcasting, because obviously real critics have worked their whole lives to be critics, and I would never call us that.
Right.
But we're not, I think, desperate right now to really, really make a financial move like that.
Yeah, it would have to really make sense for us, like
creatively,
lifestyle wise, creatively, financially also, like.
Yeah.
It would have to make sense. And because I think like the really exciting thing about having this podcast and having this kind of like hobby in our lives that I truly like look forward to, like as both like creatively, intellectually. Like I feel like it's so cool to like create something and like
yeah.
also like, feels like a project. Genuinely, like I know I keep saying it and I'm not just being like, you guys are awesome, but like you all are the reason that we are able to do this show, and just having a community of thoughtful listeners is just like, I'm just like in shock, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so in order to like grow in a way that I would feel proud of isn't the best word, but like I would feel like even comfortable with, I think like existentially, like we would have to grow in probably in our organic way where it would make sense for us to do this full time. And like we said, we wouldn't have to do something where unfortunately, I think for people who sometimes have to do this job full time, have to like sacrifice either like their honest opinion.
Yeah, that would be the worst.
Or like it's just become so much where you're like talking about a movie in a way that is not like what it deserves.
Yeah.
And so like all that to say, I think that I personally would love for this to be like a full time endeavor, but it would just have to make like a lot of sense to do that. And it would also have to make enough sense. Yeah. For me to give up this idea of like, right, like doing something else that I'm really dedicated to. And I think is like a very worthy.
There's also a world where specifically you, I think, could do both. I think we could do this podcast full time and create a business out of this, reluctantly, even though I don't think we would add like kind of any kind of corporate control to it. Where you could still keep what you're doing in education alive.
Yeah.
I think I would have to leave it completely. So it would definitely be life-changing for me the most, I think, because we could finesse a situation where that would work for you. For me, it would be like a literal life change. So it would have to make a lot of sense for us. And obviously, like, maybe not obviously, but we do want a family one day. And so like that conversation will eventually happen, because I think we'll have to make a financial decision at that point.
James is going to be guesting on a lot of pods.
James, all of a sudden, this is all of a sudden becomes a 3-person podcast. I hope he's listening. That'd be so funny. Okay. So the one thing I do want to mention about this is like, we've already said the Patreon bit. So like everyone already knows like what we're planning to do on this show. But I do want to mention that like, we have put like money, time, and effort into this show to make it work. We do everything ourselves on the show, from social media to Kelsey on graphic design, which I will call it that because they're so funny.
Don't call it that. Graphic design.
Your pictures are really funny.
No. Okay. Yeah. But that's what they are weird enough. And also sorry to everyone, for both not getting all my, you know, Instagram photos posted, like that are lining up with the episode, and then dumping them all at once. So that way the grid can be updated. So that way new listeners come and they're like, oh, they did like the Wes Anderson draft.
We do not accept your apology.
But instant they're photos. Also, please don't call it graphic design, because they
your Canva designs are great.
No, but they're like shitty and in like an endearing way.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Like it's
fun.
Like it adds to the charm. Like no. I'm not looking to like make this a perfect product.
No.
It's
we would literally pay somebody to do that at one point in the show. But we do like edit the show ourselves. Like we do the kind of audio editing ourselves. The research.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the craziest thing that we've learned in like talking to other movie podcasters, is how many movie podcasts that you, the listener, probably love that has someone else doing research.
It's fascinating.
I did not know that that was even a thing.
I think Trey and
I would never
both,
pay somebody for that.
Well, Trey and I are both like, so maybe like, I don't know, like maybe perfectionists to a point where I personally would not be comfortable. Like I would be like, I feel like I'm reading words. And sorry, now I'm sounding like I'm putting down other podcasts. I'm not at all. Like understand why people do research.
I get it, because people are busy and they also have other jobs that they do.
Like, I
just don't know how you can afford that, to be honest.
We can't pay someone for that. But also personally, like I am fascinated when like directors make like off comments, you know what I mean, about something. Like I like want to personally like really like look at everything. I just personally.
You mean when a director makes an off comment in an interview that you're doing research on?
It gives me like more insight into like what they are talking about. Or oftentimes they're asked a lot of questions like on their press junket, and there'll be one interview where they finally kind of crack and they're like, that's not really what I was trying to do. Or like, you know what I mean? Like those things are so fascinating to me, and not that they would be missed, but I just like want, I guess I just want to see them. I want to be there for it.
Yeah. I think we've had a few filmmakers on and writers on that, like after our pod is done recording, when we're just talking to them afterwards, or like in my experience, when I'm talking to them afterwards, they've like noted like, I can tell, like, you've listened to, like, all of my press interviews because you really tried to go around. I don't try to be annoying, but I do try to, like, kind of go off of what they've answered before and try to kind of mix that up. But, yeah, so we edit the podcast ourselves. I wish the audio was better, but this is the best, like, I know how to do it at this point. I'm sure it will get better with time. And yeah, so we do like kind of all the marketing ourselves and all that stuff. So Patreon makes the most sense for us right now. So even though it's like a full-time job to us, we don't want to expand it to like a literal full-time job where it's the only job. We still need our salaries and things that we do like emotionally care about and like hope for and like our institutions to make them better. Maybe that's like
we're not cutting off the possibility.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So let's get into education a little bit. Jack from Ireland.
I feel like half of our podcast has been about teaching and education.
So I'm not going to say Jack's full name, but Jack from Ireland says, really love the podcast. Thanks, Jack. Hello.
Thanks, Jack.
Hi. Found you on the Chris Stuckman episode. Great episode. Horror draft.
And that was so much fun. Oh my God.
Jack said he has become a FAST fan and he's about to start an education degree in September, which is right now.
Nice.
So this is an email probably from April. And after taking time to find out what he really wanted to do, he decided he wanted to get an education. He's wondering if we have any advice for aspiring teachers. He says, thanks and keep up the great work, Jack.
Thanks, Jack.
Thanks, Jack. So congrats on going for the education degree.
Yeah.
Thank you. You're doing a service if that is what you want to do. So we got a lot of questions about like, what is the education environment like right now?
Okay. Which we talked a little bit about earlier.
Yeah. So,
I
want to give it a little bit more nuance though, I think.
Yeah. But again, like these, so for Jack, like, and other listeners who wrote in about like the education system, like we are also talking about a very specific, like, US context. And
so that's what I was going to say.
And teaching outside of like DC, which like has other different, interesting, like social, you know, competitive and
right
strange vibes. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of constraints within education.
And we lived in a very weirdly economically segregated place where like our school was a part of a very middle class place, but also our school was like had a lot of kids coming from economically disadvantaged backgrounds. And so it was like a very specific experience. So I'm only saying that, and Kelsey's only saying that, I think, as a preface to like what we're about to say.
Yeah.
But Jack, you're Irish, okay? So just to update you in case you haven't heard or know the nuances, the United States is like in a really weird transition right now in education. And that's why me and Kelsey are struggling to probably get out a full sentence about what's going on. There is like a lot of emphasis in our country's culture right now on privatizing schools. It's been happening for a long time, like creating more charter organizations, like voucher systems, parent control of school boards, like outsiders wanting to come in and like tear up teacher unions, like all that mess is like very stressful right now for us and in education as an institution, but also like as a culture in the United States. And those powers have been like been in conflict with like the more progressive, what we would call here blue states, that are trying to create more probably experimental classrooms or like equitable learning practices and like more inclusive classroom environments and curriculum. The latter is obviously what we think is important for our democracy, not because of any political reason, but just like a human reason. But I'd say our country right now, this is why it's a struggle to talk about and give you advice really at all, because our country right now is like more interested in order and restrictions in education than we are interested in like creativity and research at the moment. And that has been our experience, and that's not true in every state. But like I said, there's like a lot of power in legislators and lobbying right now to try and decentralize education and really kind of like de-democratize education, which is scary because it puts a lot of curriculum power into the hands of the minority, which means parents and like state legislators that want to try to control their communities and their states to try to control the voting power of what happens for future generations in education. So there's like an ongoing mission to delegitimize educators and what we do every day.
Yeah.
Is the best way I can put it, I think. So it's kind of a mess.
And stressful.
and very stressful because obviously you're doing four or five different jobs and getting paid for, you know, 75% of one. So it doesn't help that our culture also isn't like super teacher friendly outside of gift cards or like thank you notes, which are nice. But like that is also like a weird part of our job, which is like our profession is like often put down in pop culture, which Jack, you've probably seen in not just like American films, but like even in Irish films, I'm assuming. And not just like movies and television, but like across the board, teachers are like often the butt of a joke or are like represented as weirdos or as somebody who like fell out of like what their dream is and like fell into teaching.
Right. Or like what we've talked about a lot on the podcast too, is a lot of like filmmakers or writers, while they have like very intellectual and interesting like ideas about the world, like sometimes, and I find this in just like casual conversations too, people remember the education system and their teachers in a narrative that is stuck in the time that they were in high school, or whatever age that was, and don't like fully like under like see their teachers still as like humans or like the situation accurately. And that's always like really fascinating
or like
to
productive
me,
assets
in a storytelling
to our democracy
sense. Okay, yeah,
or yeah, because that like that's the biggest part. It's like we are essential assets to like a working democracy, like not me and you, but like the idea of a teacher is like is vital to like the state of a working democracy. So like the idea that we're being put down is like there are active participants in trying to make our democracy as a country not work, to give states more powers and then communities more powers. So it is really scary.
Yeah. So we're also, So, I mean, we're talking about this in the context, right? Again, like it is a thankless job where we are from.
I just wanted to give nuance to thankless, because usually it's like, nobody says it's thankless. And I think people literally take that as in like, you don't get enough
like,
thank yous.
Yeah. Oh, we're not appreciated enough. No, like I don't need people to tell me thank you.
But we we do appreciate it.
I mean, thankless in the terms of like, complete lack of resources, like
emotionally, spiritually, philosophically, politically.
So are we scaring Jack out of education?
No, now I'm gonna be positive. Jack, I think the most positive part of education is like, if I lose any sleep at night, which I do, it's not because I am guilty of being a net negative in our culture or like humanity at large, if we're gonna be heady about it. Like, I think me and Kelsey are both self-aware and like confident in like what we do because we feel we are helping others. And most people who make money in industry are like having to work within a system that is like perpetuating this like self-interest and highly competitive culture, which is like obviously can be very toxic. And we don't have to like go to sleep at night feeling guilty because of our profession. And I do feel like that is something that people don't talk about enough, because you're kind of privileged to not feel guilty about what you do every day if you're a very kind of reflective person. So I do lose sleep because of like Harry Potter reboots for HBO Max, or like I lose sleep because of Top Gun Maverick being successful. But like I don't, because of like what I do for a living. And I think that is the most redeemable quality of education.
I mean, at the end of, I don't know if he asked us for advice, but now I'm just like,
thinking, I mean, he,
like,
he did ask for advice.
Okay. Well, yeah. At the end of every day, I guess, even though it is like really difficult, you're like, I am sure of like one thing that I at least like did something that is like net positive, like you're saying.
Yeah.
I do think, I am just curious to hear like what you're interested in, like what subject again that you're teaching. So reach back out to us and let us know.
Yeah. Definitely. Also, just want to add, Jack, this might be helpful. Like, this podcast has been like so validating as a teacher too. Didn't expect that. Like, speaking to all these filmmakers that we've been lucky enough to talk to and writers, most of them seem to be, if not like all of them in one way or another, inspired by teachers or influenced by teachers. And I don't just mean like, I had a favorite teacher in high school who was nice to me, so like then I wanted to be an artist. It was like, my mom was a teacher and she taught me about this idea, and then this idea led me to this filmmaker, and was like, wow, I did not realize how much education played such a large part into our favorite filmmakers' lives.
I think like almost,
I would say 90%.
I was going to say at least for the filmmakers who we've talked to, but even in our research, right? Like I think Wes Anderson, right? Even like, I think
Damien both.
Yeah. Like most of the filmmakers that we have looked at, like their parents or family has been in public education.
Yeah. Ruben Östlund was like, my mom taught me about Karl Marx and she was a teacher when I was a kid. And I was like, okay. And that's like why I got interested in learning more about philosophy and economics, and then just started to become like really absurdly invested and wanted to make bizarre movies about these ideas, which is literally what he did. So, So I don't know if I answered your question, Jack, or if Kelsey did, but I think teaching might beat you up. eventually. Yeah. And like, that's okay. We're just here to say that's okay. It's not okay, but it is okay. Like, you're going to get through it. After your first school year, I think your experience will probably give you a certain self-confidence that like you really can't put a number on, although you should, it is quantifiable and we should make more money. Like, you can put a number on it, but we just don't have the data right now. But eventually, hopefully.
Well, we don't have people who are like, yeah, maybe not data, but we don't have like people who are invested in that.
Yeah. Okay. So next question. I've heard you discuss bad representations of teachers in TV and film, but I was wondering if you have any favorite shows, movies that you feel represent teachers or the teaching profession in a positive and realistic way. Love the show. Thanks, Andrew. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew. It's a really teaching, education heavy episode. I mean, it makes sense.
I'm not going to apologize for it. We never talk about teaching. We got the most questions for teaching.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not just me about movies, but this one does combine both, which is interesting. To be honest, Andrew, and I mean this is not to you specifically. I mean this to like everybody. Like, I am not in the headspace to like answer any more questions about like the ways that teachers are misrepresented in schools. It is like kind of just like a toxic place for me to go to. And yeah.
I think we already kind of talked about it on our previous answers just now, too. But I think
they're saying in a positive way. So like that's
like, what are positive representations?
So I was gonna say it's a great question, but I just don't want to talk about the negative parts because it does. Yeah. So
let's talk about, so we just recently did a theater camp where we talked a little bit about School of Rock, and like, even though it's not Dewey, he's like pretending to be, oh no, it is Dewey. He's pretending to be Ned Schneebly.
Yeah.
While obviously there are like, you know, issues with like Jack Black's character in like certain ways. Ultimately, I think we talked a lot about how that movie, in terms of education and in terms of like talking about the purpose of education, is a really like positive portrayal of what teaching could be, because he's really focused on helping students like find what they're interested in. And obviously, like, he's, you know, very fixated on like the rock band specifically, but in terms of like the philosophy behind that, right? Yeah. Like the idea of letting like students figure out what they're interested in and like thinking about things in a new way, where the students are set up in terms of like, they want to be their parents and like they're in this private school and they think that like standardized tests are the way to like, you know, measure their value and gold stars from,
they're being indoctrinated
an institution
with like,
yeah, is the way to measure their value.
Credit score when you're a kid.
Exactly.
And so like they're being taught how to like be responsible in the world post school, but they're not being taught how to like change that world to make it better. And so like, that's where the movie's interesting, is that Jack Black is teaching them first. What starts with making the world better is like finding individually what makes you happy and purposeful. Like, that's a really beautiful message that Richard Linklater fit into that movie. But it's kind of sad that we have to rely on like a Nickelodeon film where like the teacher is kind of the butt
like
of a joke,
who's
not really
substitute.
A teacher. So yeah, it's depressing. I think like the obvious answers are like Dead Poets Society, Mona Lisa Smile, but like, or the movie I just watched, Small Change by Truffaut. There are some really interesting teacher conversations in that film. Paul Rudd and like Perks of Being a Wallflower is like a very relatable. I feel like I still haven't seen it. I know that sounds bad. I just haven't seen the movie that shows teaching in a positive and realistic way. The only problem with that is like, I think people go, okay, well, we need a happy teacher movie. No, like the problem that we have with happy teacher movies is like, we had the conversation in Abbott Elementary episodes. People can listen to that, but like, which is a great show, but we just talk about the way that educators are represented in like this kind of comedic positive way, which is kind of almost like satirizing the job, which is weird, or parodying the job.
Well, because,
is probably a better way to
phrase
it.
Because we talked about how it's like a better workplace comedy than like saying this is a teacher comedy, because ultimately like a lot of the episodes end in a like positive way. And by the way, this is also to say we've only watched the first season.
Yeah.
But a lot of the episodes were like, oh yeah, we have to buy all of our own like shit for the classroom. But at
the
end of the
day,
but at the end of the day, this is our purpose. And like, we chose this job. Like, no, like that is not.
And I made
a kid
happy today. So
I'm
happy.
It's and that's,
so
there's a lot of like, not treating teachers as like not only full humans, but like adults. Like, it's like a very strange
way that
teachers are represented. And so like, that's probably why we don't want to go. We've talked throughout all of our episodes. It's probably why people are asking this question about the negative representations. But yeah. I don't think I've fully seen it either yet, so like a realistic representation.
The paradox is that a positive and realistic teacher movie would be the most depressing movie of the year.
Sure, okay.
And so like that's why, like if I saw our experience really represented on screen, it would make me cry in the theater and I would go, that's the most positive teacher movie I've ever seen. And I know it's coming. I can feel it. And we watched a movie called Playground 2 years ago.
I was just going to say that too. Yeah. Which
is one of the best movies of the 2020s. But it's not a teacher movie necessarily, but there is a teacher in it. And that's a little bit complicated, but they do a good job of showing how broken the system is.
Right. Exactly.
So it doesn't really allow for good, like kind of happy, joy-filled teaching movies.
And it was also fascinating. So I showed my students that at the last school I was at. And we were looking at like the different choices that Wandel makes to achieve her like ultimate goal with that movie, or like what her message was. And it was fascinating to hear some of the like student responses even about like, well, the teacher should have been doing more. Mm-hmm. And even from like the lens of, you know, being in a school, like there's so many narratives about like what teachers should be doing and like not the idea of a broken system, or like in Playground, like if you're looking at that and you're thinking like, what are the teachers doing, and not like, wow, why is this like system so messed up, and why are there's not like one playground attendant, right? Like or like and one teacher on that is basically like attending to, you know, hundreds of kids, like that is the reality. And it's just like really anyway.
Me, Earl and the Dying Girl, John Berthal's teacher, I don't think that's an accurate representation, but it's a really cool representation. I just wanted to mention that
one. I forget.
He like makes his own soup and he's hanging out with, he's like his own personal office, which is like not a real thing.
Not a thing.
And that's like not a private school they're in. It's like a huge public school.
Okay.
Anyways, I think that's all I'll say about teaching. We haven't seen all of them. I'll also add that I try to stay away from teaching specific films because they do make like genuinely depressed sometimes. Not because they're sad movies, but because they're not done well. I get like kind of Fincher about it, where I'm like, this decision should have been changed.
It's like extremely. Yeah.
So
yeah. And it's not frustrating because it's not like, oh, I want to see like my job on screen. It's just like,
no,
teachers are so exploited and the education system's so broken that it really is like, it's sad, like you said, to like watch it. It's,
I'm sure if you ask an ER nurse about Scrubs, they're gonna find it funny, like how we find Abbott funny, but they're also gonna be, I mean, I think maybe ER nurses have been better represented in film and television to show the chaos of that job.
Yeah.
But maybe not to the level they should be, but
like the medical field often, from my point of view, have been like portrayed as like heroic.
Because we look at medicine as like, I'm not gonna do that.
Teachers need to be portrayed as public heroic workers. Figures. Yeah. All right.
Okay. So what's your favorite movie that you concede is bad? I just thought of one for me and Kelsey. I think it's American Hustle.
But I don't concede that that's bad. But I know that people think it's
bad. So I was going to add that people think American Hustle is bad. Okay. The filmmaker aside, not that it should be aside, but that conversation aside for right now until we do an American Hustle pod one day, which will happen. That I think is our favorite movie that hit us at the right time with some of our favorite actors of all time, who are doing some of their funniest work. Jennifer Lawrence is like in
the cleaning scene.
Insane in that movie. It is like Casino level great.
You love it, Irv.
Oh my God. Sharon Stone level. It's awesome. I think that's the one I kept thinking about. My other favorite movies that I concede are bad. I feel like it's a lot of franchise films. Like we had a lot of IP films, like Divergent is bad, but I think it's like fun. Maze Runner is sick. I don't care who hears it.
I feel like probably...
But I think it's like bad too. You know what I mean? So a lot of those movies, you could argue the whole Hunger Games franchise is bad, but I actually think some of those are well made.
I think like Hunger Games is like the most compelling of that like dystopian franchise kind of YA, you know, trend.
Yeah.
Because the story's so good, even if like there's cringy acting or like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And And I think probably number one on the list that I wanted to mention for me, I'm a Twilight boy. So like the original Twilight is special to me.
They're terrible.
Also the final Twilight, because of what happens, about how it swerves from the books. Never read the books, but I just knew what was going to happen. And then it didn't happen. And then it did happen. And I was like a whole mess. Twilight people know what I'm talking about. I can see that like a lot of franchise films like that are really bad, but they're also a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, we can think about that one some more.
Yeah. I think American Hustle probably would have been my answer too. But just because I hear it hated on so much, but I'll have to think about it.
Okay. All right. Movies that you're that you're both embarrassed you haven't seen? So I'm not going to fully answer this question just because I purposely haven't seen a lot of movies. Like in the like on the pod in recent episodes, maybe I think we talked about this. We call movies that we haven't seen purposely yet that we're saving wine cellar movies. That's like something that
like bottle of wine
that we've like
movies,
trademarked
yeah.
on our show. Yeah, bottle of wine movies that like we've put away purposely. Like we're waiting for the right moment. The biggest one, which I will say, I'm just going to say one because there's a lot of filmmakers that I really want to watch that we're going to get into in a second that I still haven't caught up with a lot of their best work. But the biggest movie that is like probably the most culturally significant that I have not seen is Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. I haven't seen the movie. It's one of those films where you've seen every image, so you kind of have an idea of what is coming. And I've also seen, I think, every Tarantino film besides Pulp Fiction. But yeah, I haven't seen that one. So that's probably the biggest one that I've just like left sitting there. That has a little bit to do with like me wanting to wait for his final film, which he is like very adamant about making a one last film because that's
we
the
just
kind
had
of
someone ask us that. We were like
the movie critic,
at a brewery,
I think that's what it's called.
With some friends, and someone was like, "Do you think like he'll actually stick to it?
I do.
Do you think he will?
He's stubborn. Yeah. Okay. I think he will, but he's gonna figure out another way to kind of make something like a yeah. TV show. He's gonna make like a 6-hour, 2-part Netflix, what he's gonna call like some kind of short series or whatever, yeah. but not a real movie. Or he'll go into like plays or writing novels. I'm sure he'll find something to keep him busy. He has a good podcast too. I'm sure he's gonna keep himself busy.
Sure.
I'm not
his whole movie theater, yeah.
I'm not a Tarantino guy, not gonna explore that on the podcast right now. But like I'm just not.
Although we don't dislike Tarantino movies.
I think Inglourious Basterds yeah. is his best movie. I think it's one of the top 100 movies I have on my list. I think it's on my top 100.
For me, we talked about this a little bit earlier on in the pod and how I'm like very excited to revisit, especially like horror classics, which I have interestingly found actually aren't scary to me. And maybe that has to do with some of the effects, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also I enjoy that they're usually not focused on gore, like we have talked about many times in any of our horror episodes. Like we got when we were growing up with like Saw and
yeah.
like very, you know, focused of like gore horror movies that I always associated with the horror genre, like just growing up and always never wanted to watch them. But I think for me, it would always be like movies like The Shining, right? Or Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
Movies that people would definitely be like, what, you haven't seen this? I like can't believe that. And I've obviously seen like, you know, different things like The Twins and stuff like that. But I have for the most part, like really not known what the plot of those movies are.
Yeah.
And so when we recently watched it, it was one of the first movies we watched when we went to like move to Colorado. And it's set in Colorado.
Yeah, like very close to us. Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, so
I had only seen it a few times, so I didn't really remember that. And it's not one of my favorite movies, and so like I didn't remember it at all that it was in Colorado. So that was interesting.
Yeah, so that was just so funny. But also like I'm just really enjoying like The Exorcist, right? Like too, I just saw for the first time. Like so, all these movies that people
you saw
are,
Halloween
like,
for the first time last year.
You've never seen these, but yeah, but those it's interesting because I actually like really. Think those movies are fascinating because I don't find them as scary, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've talked a lot about, I think, on this podcast, like why you've stayed away from horror movies for so long. But okay. Next question. Guilty pleasure movies. Okay. I only wrote down one for me. I don't know if you have one in mind that you just put on. You have guilty pleasure television.
Yeah.
I'm not sure
yes.
about movies. My guilty pleasure movie is 1985's Clue.
Okay, yeah.
That I didn't put in, like, you know, favorite movie that you concede is bad, because I actually think Clue is a masterpiece, like, of comedy. and I think it should not be remade, but at the same time, I want it to be remade, because I would love to see, like, the kind of Perrault-ification to Clue. I don't want to see that exact movie remade, but I would like to see other movies in that kind of, that format.
I like this idea
of, like, having different endings. I just think it's yeah. a really meta, funny movie that is kind of, like, it starts a genre in itself.
Right. And also I think the idea of maybe like a more 2023 like menu kind of idea of Clue, like looking at class within like the Clue attendees.
So we should email
right?
Mattel
like,
and yeah. make the next Monopoly film or make the next Clue film.
Yeah.
Okay. Three filmmakers. Do you have any guilty pleasure movies that you want to mention?
So, I don't really have any like guilty pleasure movies.
Is there not a movie that you like to watch every other year? Like, do you think 1994's Little Woman?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So like, but I don't know if I like identify it as guilty pleasure as much as like, yes, like I'm gonna watch this. This is like my yearly movie. So I guess that could be a camp that people would put that in. But yeah, like, so every, you know, like holiday season and when it gets cold,
yeah,
I watch 1994 Little Women. And I think like Joe March, just for me growing up, was a really influential film. I guess I should have talked about that at the beginning of the pod when we had that question. But Joe March, I was like, yeah, like, fuck yeah. She like rejected Christian Bale.
Joe March, I was like, fuck yeah.
that should was just be like the
Little
Woman
t-shirt.
Yeah, there were not a lot of like, I think, you know, characters who were women who were interested, right? Like, obviously we've talked about like in intellectual pursuits, like for themselves, like outside of seeking a man's attention romantically, like obviously,
even though by the end of the film,
yeah,
seeking a man's,
well, but okay, yeah, yeah,
it's such a very complicated
Greta Gerwig like movie, you know, obviously corrects that storyline of like having someone have to end up with a romantic partner at the end of the movie. But I think we'll talk about it. We'll do 1994. Yeah. Yeah. She talks about like how her
but she still ends up with.
Yeah. But she talks about how her publisher like wanted her to have the main character, Joe March, like end up with a man. Right.
Okay. I don't want to step on this conversation because I'm sorry. Cause we wanted to do the 1994 Little Woman versus the 20.
Before we get into spoilers and we'll talk about it. But I think it's interesting in its own way in the 1994 version, but yeah, that's something that I think like is maybe my guilty pleasure. I was just gonna say, but then like I'd have to add About Time in there, and that's not really a guilty pleasure. It's just like
Richard Curtis movies,
an amazing movie that I love watching every like Valentine's Day, you know,
the Julia Roberts Hugh Grant one too, that I'm just forgetting the name of.
Notting Hill.
Yeah, thank you. Notting Hill.
So there are a lot of actually rom-coms too that are like guilty pleasures, I think, for me.
And a lot of sci-fi movies for me that are like disturbing science fiction movies that I know are bad, but like a ton of fun.
Well, and also though, like I think something interesting about like having the pod is that we really try to watch new movies all the time, whether they're, you know, from the past or current movies. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really have as much time to rewatch movies as much as I think I did maybe before.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point.
It feels
point.
Like we're always behind. I'm like, oh my God, like we have so much.
Yeah, we have our Google calendar is nuts, y'all.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just remembered, what's your favorite movie that you concede is bad? My favorite one in the past, like 5-6 years is Life.
Life. Oh, the alien
movie?
The
Jake Gyllenhaal, Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
And I think Rebecca Ferguson, I want to say, is in that.
I don't remember.
Great film. Okay. In as far as it's alien without any theme. So it's kind of sick, but really stupid. And I think that it's like a lot of fun and it feels like a prequel to Venom or something.
Yeah, I disagree.
Okay. Three filmmakers I know you do.
Just passing over it.
I also love Kristen Stewart, and there's a Kristen Stewart film called Underwater, which is a weird science fiction movie that I had a ton of fun with.
Wait. Oh, Underwater. Okay. I thought you were moving on to the next question. I want to know.
I am. So, but like, I keep remembering
this
bad
question is
now.
Basically to me, like, at least with who are people who have like long term partners. What is the movie that it's like, I have to ask my partner, like, can we watch this tonight? Because I really want to watch this, and I know you're not going to want to watch this, right? Like, I'm fascinated by that because, like, that would be something like Life that you, like, know I actively, like, don't really want to, like, spend however much time on. Like,
for me, I feel like if I asked you tonight to watch The Lighthouse, you'd probably not
be
in.
I'd be like, okay. Yeah, like, it's not like I dislike The Lighthouse. It's just, like, you have to be in a very certain mood to watch The Lighthouse.
Call it a random Tuesday night for me then, because I'm down right now.
Call in, DM in with your
listeners, let us know. That's a funny thing. Ask your partner to see what that is. Okay, three filmmakers you plan to become more familiar with in the near future, and then after this we have only like a few more questions. So I have a ton of filmmakers. Instead of just naming three, I was just gonna say like a lot of Asian cinema that I need to watch, like from the masters, and then get into like the categories of like underrated works. And then I've kind of done a good job of entering into the basic French New Wave scene. I'm trying to get now into like more German early like 20th century expressionism. Like I'm trying to like really widen the scope of what I'm used to. I have a good handle over kind of like deeply masculine American films that I've like already kind of watched multiple times at this point. I think a filmmaker that's the big one is probably Akira Kurosawa. I think Spike Lee, I need to revisit a lot of his filmography in terms of American filmmakers. Truffaut, I've done a good job of almost finishing like his top works, but I want to go into his more underrated stuff. We own a lot of Kubrick films that I haven't seen. One that I'm really excited to is one of my bottle of wine movies is Barry Lyndon. Cause I think that in terms of the way it's been described to me has been, I think one that might be my favorite of his without seeing it, even though 2001 A Space Odyssey is excellent. There's a ton y'all. So I do a better job, but it's really like regional for my mind. Like I'm like, oh, I need to go more into like, Eastern Europe. I need to go more into Southwest Asia. Like it's just kind of like a very specific.
You have a map in your mind. Yeah. It's so interesting to like come home and Trey will be like, I just finished a movie and I think it's the best movie I've ever seen. Like one of the best movies I've ever seen. Like that is recently? So cool. Just for you. Like I'm happy for you to have that experience. But I'm also jealous because, well, now for listeners who didn't know, Trey and I worked together for
6 years.
Yeah. So like we would commute together. We would have lunch together. Like, which I know some people are like, what? Like a lot of people have always said, like, how can you, you know, work with your spouse? Like that's just too much time. But I don't know. We don't get sick of each other. But now it's like weird because we have totally opposite schedules. We have to watch movies at different times and like really, really schedule out like what we're doing even more so with the pod. And so that's why also like pod episodes have been like maybe weirdly timed just in our moving transition. But like, so that is sad because like, I feel like I laugh less a little bit in the day.
I don't get enough time to think about that.
Yes.
Because I'm so tired and busy every day. Yeah. But that does make me sad thinking about when that does hit me. I'm eventually going to be less stressed. I'm like starting 2 new curriculums and I'm in a brand new school with a bunch of new kids. So it's a little bit different for me. But like that will hit me very soon.
You're like treading water right now. But anyway, it's really genuinely cool that like you are checking out all these movies like during the times where I'm like doing my thing and that you are having experiences like of this is one of the best things I've ever seen. Like this
it's mind-blowing.
Is a transgressive like film. It's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one it recently happened to was A Man Escaped.
That's the one. Yeah, that's the one.
And you came home and I was like, that is one of the most well-made movies I've ever seen in my entire life. And like instantly went in my top 20, which is so crazy because most of the movies in my top 20 I've seen 3+ times. Okay, so Desert Island, fun question. What is a director's filmography that you would choose if you had to be on a desert island for the rest of your life?
Desert island. So this is like an interesting question always. Because
it's not the best filmmaker.
Well, yeah, because it's like, okay, so I think the question like in general, not specifically if you, the listener, like are asking this, maybe what you intended, but like the question as I read it as like a question in general is like, if you were psychologically separated from everyone on earth and you're alone,
yeah, you're isolated
and you are in a very fragile state as
a human.
Are you
conceding because you're going to say something like,
well, you think you might die out there. You know, we've all seen Castaway. Sure. You make friends with like inanimate objects, like you're searching for food. Like what movies would you want to keep you sane? And that's a very different, answer for that question of like, what are the best movies ever made, which is what the listener might like truly just be asking. So I'm very sorry if I'm not answering your question, but I'm going to answer in the only way I know how of like what movies would keep me not from like just like losing it all. I think I'd have to pick like kind of talky movies. I think I'd have to pick movies that kind of like spark something a little fun, like not completely like Transformer action movies. But maybe, I don't know, like A Few Good Men or something, like movies that I feel like would be fun, but also.
Okay. So like Rob Reiner's filmography.
Keep me in it.
I feel like the easy answer for you, which is just weird timing, is Wes Anderson. I think he's got such a funny
way of writing. Yes, and he works for both of those kind of sides of the answer.
Yeah. No, I know. He does a great job with emotions and drama, but also is like one of the more absurd filmmakers that gets big budgets. Edgar Wright's another good, I think, answer for this question. Jordan Peele, if he had more than three movies, would be great. If we can include his Comedy Central stuff, like then it's like game over at that point. Yeah, those are good answers, I think. For me, probably Paul Thomas Anderson. Because,
well, are you bringing movies for, in my like understanding of the question, or are you bringing movies because they're the best?
Both, because it's Paul Thomas Anderson. And I don't care how, like, I understand the masculine critique on like how all of his movies are about tortured men, but they're also some of the most funny movies, I think.
Yeah.
I think Phantom Thread is one of the funniest movies ever made.
It's so I can't wait to like one day do that on the pod.
Well, he's coming out with a movie satirizing the Republican Party in like 2 years.
Yeah.
So we're going to be doing his, which is a crazy idea if that's really what that movie's about, for PTA, because he usually doesn't do like a lot of contemporary work. But
if anyone saw my
I'd be fascinated by
my
that.
Letterboxd review, I watched The Young Karl Marx. It was like a biopic. And Vicky Krieps played his wife. And I was like,
Karl Marx's wife?
Want her movie. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And also, if you saw my my Letterboxd review, I felt like there was a lot of sexual tension between Marx and Engels.
Just putting it out there.
And just
Kelsey
it
was
out
just
there.
Putting it out there. I didn't
think
watch
they had
it,
a connection.
But I believe you.
But also
somebody that we somebody that we have complicated feelings about, but I think would still be a lot of like very entertaining would be Christopher Nolan. I think that seems like in terms of like fun filmographies. Because I was trying to think, you have to be get a little excited. Like Fincher's too dark.
Could you bring
Denis
any horror
too
movies?
Messed up.
Yeah, like
Martin Scorsese, John Carpenter would be a lot of fun.
Would that just send you like deeper into despair?
I think a good mix of that is somebody who does a good job with despair but is exciting is Ridley Scott. Like I think I talked a lot about him.
Oh
already,
yeah, a lot of Ridley Scott movies would be great.
Yeah, I mean, plus you have House of Gucci if you just need a second to laugh, but also feel bad about laughing.
I would probably bring About Time.
Okay, so Richard Curtis is a really good choice for a filmmaker because he's like made so many funny rom-coms. Okay, so I think that's pretty good. I'm going to land on PTA though. I think it makes the most sense for my sensibilities, and I think Wes makes sense, I guess, for you.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for selecting my Desert Island.
I was thinking about that one a lot because I don't want to be basic.
No,
but...
I meant like you're like sending me off, you know.
Oh yeah.
To this desert island.
Goodbye.
With love.
How do you land your guests? And who are your dream guests?
Oh, wow.
So we got this question, actually, I think the second most next to a teaching question, or would you quit your jobs to do this full time? All right. So we've been working to try to get out of talking to studios and publicists and agents in order to like go directly to the creatives because of the strikes. Like that's what we've been trying to do lately, which has been very difficult. Obviously we still have had filmmakers on during the strikes because we've gone to them directly. So it's worked out for us. But in the past when we have big filmmakers on our big writers on that are very popular and like are trying to spread awareness of their films, and that's what we're trying to do too. We usually work with going straight to the publicist agents being like, here's our work. And then we make a connection and we're good. And then there are cases in which they reach out to us and where we respond if we're too busy, or we respond and we're like, let's do it.
Yeah.
So it's happened both ways.
It also has to be like a movie that we like.
Totally.
Yeah.
Or it's a filmmaker that reaches out to us. And so like that has happened too. So like we...
Yeah, which is like the most validating
biggest compliment
experience
ever.
Yeah. Like when Zach Krieger like reached out to us, that was like... So cool. I mean, he's just awesome too. Like,
I mean,
I'm
that was
so
one of our first interviews
for his
too.
Career. Yeah, but he's also just like such a nice guy.
Yeah, totally. And you know, we've created a solid connection with him, so it's been nice to see him successful now with Weapons being financed, and like that movie's gonna be huge when it comes out. Okay, so dream guests, just quickly because we're on the last two questions here. The first name I wrote down was Timothée Chalamet.
Yeah.
Makes the most sense for our show. We've already been in contact with his agents and publicists pre-strike, and that actually seemed like something we were going to try to work out toward Dune. Dune's now been pushed back.
Yeah. Obviously, that's not happening now.
Yeah.
Maybe
I still
day.
Don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I also, you know, I don't really know how that conversation would go because at one point I'm trying to be like a normal movie podcaster and be like, let me ask you some fun questions at this another point. Be like, do you want to be friends? Is that something you'd be interested in? You don't know me, but no, I'm just kidding. But Chalamet would be a lot of fun. He's like one of the most important actors to us right now. Damien Chazelle.
Yeah.
We've already been in contact with him.
He's a surprise to any listeners.
Not a surprise. He's an incredible person.
We would love to have Greta on.
Greta would be a ton of fun. She definitely fits the kind of humor on our show, I think.
I would love to talk to Noah and Greta just like...
together?
Yeah.
Noah would combust.
Couple interview.
Yeah, just you saying that, I think he would just like turn into flames. Jennifer Lawrence, again, makes a lot of sense for us. The big filmmakers that we would never get that I'm not sure I could even talk to without kind of like just feeling like a shit. It would be Paul Thomas Anderson, Denis Villeneuve, Ridley Scott, David Fincher, Ryan Coogler, like... Ari Eggers, Gerwig too, like people we talked about a lot, like Garland, yeah. Matt Reeves.
We'll never
Jordan Peele
probably come on the pod, yeah.
Is someone who we actually did get to like that second part of like how to get somebody on your podcast mm-hmm. or on your show where it was like very close to happening. And Matt Reeves too for the Batman about like a year ago now. So those are pretty big. And then the most reasonable person I think we could get on the show that I'm really excited to have on one day is Barack Obama. I thought you would laugh quicker, but
I was just, I mean, he is in movies.
Well, his daughter's in movies. Yeah, so true. Like, or she's in the studio now. So like, I think it's not crazy to think he would come on and talk about, did he actually watch the movies that are the favorite movies of his of the year? That's what I would like to ask him. But yeah, Obama. And then the biggest name I think that's most important to like my childhood that we've actually almost had on the show, which is the almost had on the show is a lot of people. It's a long list because it's just tough with timing because we're teachers. So like we have to wait till we get home
like
and
often,
hours don't work.
Yeah.
So you can imagine listeners like how that goes. Like as soon as I get off work, it's like rushing.
Yeah. It's kind of frustrating because like, it's like, you know, if this were our full-time job,
it would be
like,
a lot easier.
We would be able to like fit in interviews, but like oftentimes we have a very, very narrow like time slot that we can do the interviews, and that obviously doesn't always work out with people's schedule. And so it's like so sad when like we can't do something because of that.
Yes. So the coolest one I can say that we've exchanged like emails and like have like figured and talked about like the show and trying to come on and like movie inspirations is Damien. We've already talked about that. Like is Chazelle. But the one that we were so close to multiple times now that I'm convinced is going to happen is Gyllenhaal. Is Gyllenhaal will be on the extra credits. It's going to happen. I know it is because we're already in like
and
that second.
And he's our special guest on Sunday for Prisoners.
He's actually here right now. That will happen. So any other names that I'm forgetting off the top of my head?
No, I mean like listeners probably know, like I know Trey just said some actors, but mainly like we are not interested in having actors on the show. And I'm not even really like, it wouldn't go like weird or whatever. I'm more fascinated by asking questions to filmmakers.
Yeah.
But I think like for actors, it is interesting to think about like what kind of like experiences have they had with different director choices? Like those things are interesting to me.
So Jake makes the most sense because he's worked with some of like the most important filmmakers of the 21st century. So like Gyllenhaal coming on, it would be a lot of fun to pick his brain about the way he's like his creative style of acting when working with those filmmakers. But the actor we almost had on, which would have just been a fun time culturally, was Rachel Sennett. Like that,
right,
she almost came on, and that would, we usually don't ask agents or publicists of actors or ask actors directly, but she was one where we were way ahead of it. And so like we asked like pre-bodies, like she was about to come on the show and then we had like a scheduling conflict. But I think she's probably now too podcasting
too big,
is not really something she's going to be into. All right. So I'm going to combine two questions.
I do want to say really quick.
Yeah.
I said this on the Nope podcast also. And also the pod that we did with Charles Holmes looking at Jordan Peele's like filmography.
Yeah.
But Jordan Peele is a Pen 15 fan and I want to have him on obviously because Jordan Peele would be like a dream guest.
Oh.
But I would love to talk Pen 15 with him.
What about Maya Eskrin though?
We have reached out and I, right now, like,
well, her and Donald Glover are about to be doing press for, Mr. and Mrs.
Smith.
Yeah.
So maybe we should reach out again, but we have like, cold emailed because I would love to have the Pen 15 creators on the
me too
pod.
And Charlotte Wells is confirmed for her
and
next
also
movie,
like
so that's pretty cool.
Well, maybe okay for the next mailbag we can also think of like actors because I was thinking filmmakers, but like, you know, like different actors I would be interested in talking to who are kind of like in our like age group who also just like would be fascinating to talk to, like Daniel Kaluuya.
Oh yeah,
or like, you know what I mean, like people who are kind of like in in that our millennial age range, exactly.
Late Gen Z, early millennial group.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why Chalamet made the most sense, because he just is like literally our age and has the same taste because of being growing up in the same generation, which is like somebody who was inspired by Heath Ledger's Joker to become an actor. Like, that sounds literally like one of our friends, and that's just like what 28-year-old like psychopaths sound like. Okay, so I'm going to combine two questions just because we're pushing it here. I'm sure people are enjoying this if you clicked a mailbag 2.5 hours.
Well, if you made it this far,
yeah,
hopefully.
So these are actually great questions that I'm going to combine. I think maybe from the same person who, if you know who you are, you're one of our favorite listeners.
And also these next time we will ask to say people's names so that way we can read it on the pod. Sorry, everyone.
So first question, how scared should moviegoers be about AI writing scripts? Second question, do moviegoers have a responsibility to go to indie theaters instead of big chains? Sorry. So this is like a socially conscious, film goer who asked these questions, obviously. And these are things that we think about a lot when it comes to theater chains, especially. AI writing scripts seems like one of these kind of like inevitable dystopian moments that is happening, and that's why these strikes are going on. I think this question was even pre-strikes, which is fascinating. So there is a little bit of kind of like, we saw this coming to this question. So as for AI writing scripts, like, structural unemployment is normal, but like, this is not that. So anybody trying to downplay AI writing scripts or like taking over creative agency from artists, this is like dystopian level shit. So like, the idea of creativity being packaged and commodified is like what studios want. And I think the only way as consumers of movies that we can literally, like, practically combat that is trying our best not to go out and enjoy multiple times studio films that feel like they're written by computers. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
The best example, and even though it's a well-made film, I think, of last year was Top Gun Maverick. Another good example is Avatar, The Way of Water. I think Marvel franchise has now, broken my heart and turned into that, where it does feel like AI is writing scripts at this point, where the humanity has been stripped and the kind of like creating a mirror image of every movie before it has been like put into like this algorithm to like this formulaic cycle that is just destroying the art form. So I think it is up to the consumers a little bit to hold high expectations for films. Like, they are entertaining and they should be, but AI will be even more inevitable if we only expect entertainment alone. And so, like, I think we do have a little bit of a responsibility when it comes to choosing not to see movies multiple times that are kind of written so cynically or from a computer perspective.
Yeah. And I guess it ties right into this listener's like question about supporting independent movie theaters, like,
which is a total privilege. Like, if you have access to an indie theater, you should be going, because not everybody does. So like, it's an easy thing to say, like, I don't want to go to AMC Regal, but if that's the only access you have to movie theaters because of corporations buying up small businesses, like, of course, like, that is going to be like your only way to see that movie that you want to see. So like, we use franchises when we go see, like, at a Regal and AMC, we use them to go see movies that we wouldn't ordinarily be able to see. Like, Passages is a movie that came out this year, which is one of the best films of the past few years.
Yeah.
And it was only playing at an AMC like 35 minutes from us. And it wasn't playing at like a company that isn't like publicly traded on the stock market, like Alamo Drafthouse. It wasn't playing at Alamo Drafthouse. And so like, we had to go to an AMC or Regal. But Alamo Drafthouse is not exactly an independent film, theater by any means. So we try to go and support like Angelica Theater when we can. There is a Denver theater that we have not like been exposed to that scene yet, and we haven't gone out there yet into downtown Denver to go to that theater, but we are excited to. So if you have access to cities or suburban areas where you can see movies at indie theaters, obviously, I think, like, if we're spending that much money on movies, we do have a little bit of a responsibility, like, economically, to figure that out. And the best thing you can do is vote appropriately.
Yes.
Which is, like, I think the easiest way to kind of go about that.
I was looking at when Passages comes out on Mubi, but I can't find it.
Hopefully soon. I can contact them, because I meant to do that to figure out a date. But I think they're going to be announcing that soon. Okay. Last question. Great question. I wanted to save this for last because there's so many answers to it. But what are your favorite podcasts or film podcasts?
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So I think, we obviously love the Big Picture.
I think number one
for movie podcasts. Yeah. And
we don't want to like kiss ass here about like corporations, like yeah. The Ringer and Spotify working together to make podcasts that kind of monopolize all of movie podcasts. Like The Big Pick does. Yeah, there have are also access to,
we'll, but we'll shout out some independent podcasts too.
We will, I think, definitely. But The Big Pick is the most influential.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously, like, because you know certain movie podcasts are. Like have, you know, that's their job. Like they have the capacity to like talk about every movie, right? Versus like, independent podcasts or like looking at different things. So anyway, so I think I love the Big Pick for that reason, because you know, Sean and Amanda on The Big Picture, and Chris Ryan too, like The Watch, and Andy Greenwald is also one of my favorite pods. I'll listen to Andy and Chris talk about TV shows that I don't watch, just because I really enjoy Chris and Andy's conversation.
Yeah.
I actually would probably
take the industry too.
I would maybe listen to them like maybe more than even The Big Picture, like if they did cover movies, just because I'm watching more movies.
Okay.
Because I think of like Andy's sensibilities. With The Big Pick though, you know, we were lucky enough to have Sean on for our Damien Chazelle filmography pod.
Still haunts me to this day that I was like very sick on that episode. I like literally could not think about every sentence.
Well, Trey later found out, we never really talked about this on the pod, but Trey later found out that he had bronchitis.
Yeah. And Sean was supposed to come on like way earlier in the year. Yeah. Like not even in 2023. He was supposed to come on in 2022, I think. Like we had been talking for a year for him to come on, and he'd been so busy and he had just found like an open spot and I had just gotten sick. And it was like during our spring break too. It was like the weirdest situation. And I was like, oh, come on. And it's about Chazelle too. So one day we'll have to have him on again, cause like, I'd love to do a different episode on something that he picks. But yeah, The Big Pick, one of the best pods out there for movies and conversations about movies. And honestly doing what we try to do, which is spread awareness of new releases. So people continue like movie culture.
Yeah.
Which is really important. Making movies matter.
Yeah. And I used to, I think when I watched more Marvel movies, I used to listen to Ringerverse like with Mallory Rubin and like with Van
Binge Mode too.
And Charles. Yeah.
Jason Concepcion.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's not at the Ringer anymore. But yeah. So I think like a lot of Ringer pods, just because obviously like we were talking about, they're able to like cover current movies and keep up with it at a, you know, a capacity because that's their full-time jobs. But I think in terms of like independent movie podcasts, we just went on Cinemathology and I really enjoyed their podcasts.
Yeah, they're great. I mean, obviously we both love, but you listen to them quite often. Grierson and Leach, who was on our show last year to do the 2022 movie draft, who I hope to have back one day soon. I think you already mentioned her, but Mallory Rubin is like very special to us. Anytime she's on a podcast, like Rewatchables or, you know, like Kelsey said, Ringerverse, we'll always listen to her. They Are Just Movies, or They're Just Movies, is a really fun podcast. Carpool Critics shut down their pod, but we love that show. I think they did a great job when they were running it. We both really got into New Books Podcast Network during the pandemic.
Yeah,
the
if worst you of the pandemic. Don't know about New Books Podcast Network,
it's not a movie podcast.
Yeah, not a movie podcast, although they do have a film section. So basically they like cover new books literally in a certain field. So there's like a New Books sociology page, New Books economics, New Books like,
and they bring
policy.
On academics who come on and so talk about their books or work.
Yeah, and they do it in film too, like but I mean, that's one of my favorite pods. I listen to that like almost every day.
Yeah.
And it's just like fascinating to hear different studies that are current, like that are happening around topics that you're interested in different fields, and not have to read an entire book, but really get the like rundown of what their study found. Another podcast though for movies, specifically with my new appreciation for horror movies, is The Evolution of Horror.
It's the best horror podcast.
Yeah, it's great.
There's a lot of great horror podcasts, but The Evolution of Horror is the best horror podcast. One I'm most jealous of when it comes to audio too.
Yeah. We should reach out. But you know what? I want listeners with this question to send their recommendations of other like independent pods that they listen to.
So other ones, I have a bunch, like Black Man Can't Jump is a great podcast. Blank Check, obviously, is the most famous one. Raiders has been a guest multiple times. We love James and Anthony's work.
Screen Drafts, fun.
Screen Drafts, ton of fun. Eye of the Duck has been a guest on multiple times. They're great. Beyond the Screenplay has been on before. They're great. One of the podcasts that's a movie podcast about film history that I have the most saved podcast to listen to later besides New Books is You Must Remember This with Karina Longworth, who is partnered with Rian Johnson.
Yeah.
She is so smart and like thoughtful and caring about like trying to like catalog like different eras of film history and trying to like explore parts of film history that have been unacknowledged or misinterpreted and trying to like reframe them with a more like historical lens, which is and a modern lens too, which is interesting. And she has like good guests on sometimes too. So I'm really excited, like on long car drives, always to like throw her show on. Like I think they do a great job of exploring parts of film history that you wouldn't know about unless you were like a film, you know, major, which I wasn't. So it is really nice to not always have to read, you know, film history books, which I do enjoy, but listen to her show. Mm-hmm. Bulletproof Screenwriting is really good. Film at Lincoln Center are really good. Both of those are good at interviewing directors, filmmakers, and writers, which I enjoy. And the
we should also shout out Chris Duckman's new podcast, who Trey has been listening to for a very long time, like through his YouTube videos. Yeah. And obviously he came on the show, which was cool, to do the horror 2023 draft, which I think I won in my heart, but I guess I think that about every draft. But Chris is awesome. And he is right now like making a film, Shelby Oaks. And he brings on filmmakers to talk about like, how do you actually do this practically? Like, mm-hmm. what were things that you didn't know and like discovered through this process to make it more accessible for people to make movies, which is awesome.
Yeah. I can't wait for that film to come out. We're going to definitely support it. 70 Millimeter is a great podcast, Film Spotting, Sleazoids. Like there's a lot of great ones. Like Film Comment podcast did a great Oppenheimer episode. I'm just like looking at my Spotify right now. I think that's it for right now. And I'm sorry for anybody I left off who listens to the show, who has their own movie podcast. Like I literally listen to so many.
If you can tell, Trey and I are listening to podcasts all the time. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's our job,
well, yeah,
but also we enjoy it.
Yeah.
And but it's tough because we like to read more and like,
yeah,
like well, have other, like do other things that we intellectually and like and emotionally engage with and like really enjoy doing.
See friends
would be nice. Like when we went out to drink with some great friends like last week and had a great time. But at the same time, we were supposed to watch like two movies that night. And I was like, oh, I got to put these back on the watch list. And the last one I'll mention is Cinema of Meaning, which does a lot of what we do on our show, but they do it in like hour long episodes instead of 3 hour long episodes. But I'm not afraid of a 3 hour long episode. All right. So I think that's it. We did a really good job. There were other, you know, great questions that like I'm going to save off for future mailbags. Thank you for sending in questions. Thank you to listening to this show. Thank you for supporting it with like just listening in general,
like,
but also
seriously, thank you all so much. We could not have the show without you. And also like you all have surpassed, I guess, just any expectation that I would have of listeners for our show. Like I said, I thought we would stop the pod, but also I just didn't like, you know, I guess I didn't expect that we would find so many like cool, like genuinely intelligent, caring people who love movies.
And I use the word a lot, but kind.
Yeah.
Like our listeners are kind. And like that is like, from what I can tell from other movie podcasts, seems like it's rare. I appreciate that.
We're
about
waiting.
All of you.
We're waiting for our mean messages, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, we do have hate listeners. There are a few people who message us in the
past
who like will follow us and then unfollow us like every week.
Yeah, but I always assume, you know, that's not us. There's something.
There's like five or six
something
people.
Something going on.
And for you,
in your life,
for all
listen,
of you,
if you're
gonna we take wish the best
DM
for you. You could say, we here for you. We're here for you. Okay.
We're here for you. But so thanks everyone for listening. Please rate and review us. It only takes a second. Even if you literally just say, thanks, it helps us get found.
Exclamation point. Just as a program reminder, obviously we have, like we said already, we have Prisoners coming out next week, which is a big deal for the show. We'll have great guests on for that. We have a Patreon announcement episode that'll tell you how to sign up for Patreon. Then you'll have Wes Anderson episodes available on Patreon if you're patrons. We're eventually going to do an About Time podcast because it's a 10-year anniversary.
Yeah.
Scorsese month is next month, which we've been planning for a long time. We have a Scorsese movie draft with really cool guests coming out in a few weeks.
And we'll be doing some Scorsese on the Patreon.
Yes.
And it's also horror
There will
season.
Be a horror episode
okay.
on the main
you'll
feed,
be
horror
able to
episode
pick
on Patreon.
A horror movie that we cover.
Yeah, patrons will be able to vote for certain things. Okay, this was the Extra Credits Mailbag, our first one. Tune in next week for our episode on Prisoners. This has been Trey.
And this is Kelsey.
Peace.
Bye.
been missing.